Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about distributed transactions and why we couldn't implement this idea of multiple machines coordinate to either do an operation together or not do it in cases of failures, network or machine, with sort of our naive solutions. We saw that, well, with naive solutions, while values were being changed, like someone, third party, could observe some in the middle values that would be inconsistent, that wouldn't make sense. We need something like locking to kind of prevent that. And on failures, sort of our naive solutions could end up leaving the operation half done, and leaving it that way indefinitely, unless we had some way of somehow figuring out, oh, this operation was in progress and we had a failure, we need to finish it. So we saw this mechanism, two-phase commit, which is sort of a way of coordinating that sort of avoids these problems. And it's called two-phase commit because we have two phases. We have this prepare phase where we see if everyone could do the operation, and this commit, this finishing phase where everyone does it. And to make sure this survives failures, we use the same idea we did with redo logging, which is we log our intended actions before we do them. So on a failure, we can look at our log and figure out what we were intending to do and make sure that actually happens. We looked at sort of formalizing this protocol, and we finished up looking at mapping this to a state machine, which kind of gives us a systematic way of thinking about it. We can think of, oh, the current state, that's what we're intending to do. We record that in our log. On a failure, we redo what got us into that state and continue the actions in that state. And knowing what state we're in, are we like collecting votes? Are we telling everyone to finish? We can figure out what we do for each type of message we get. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes? So the last question of the quiz. Okay. So on the quiz, we asked, said that we have a system that's updating item information on A1 and an order stored on B1. We have a coordinator. This, we're using two-phase commit for this. And the coordinator machine figures out that, oh, everyone agrees to commit the transactions. But before it can tell everyone, hey, we're going to do this, it fails. And the question is, what could happen before the coordinator recovers? And what we have to do on A1 and B1 is we don't know on A1 and B1, we don't have the information to know, is this operation actually going to complete or not? So you have to plan around, maybe it's not. And what can we do while this operation's pending? Well, we can do anything we want with other items and other orders, probably, as long as there's no sort of connection. Like, say, you know, running out of an item or having, you know, debiting in a customer's account too much, there's no sort of connection, then there shouldn't be any problems with other operations. They don't interfere. So we can compute other transactions that involve things on the same machine. Say on these machines B1 and A1, they can just do other transactions as long as they don't involve the same items and customers, right? There should never be a problem with that. There has to be some sort of connection for us to say, oh, sorry, I can't let you do this order because I don't need to know what's happening with this other order. And that means that, you know, A and B should be correct, that because those other transactions could involve different items and orders, we could do them. We can't complete any transaction, but we can complete certainly a lot of transactions that involve other things. For C, if we have a new transaction that definitely is like trying to replace the old one, we can't discard the previous one without, you know, some way of figuring out that, oh, you know, that transaction is definitely not going to happen. So the problem is, you know, we can see, we know from the question that the earlier transaction is stalled, but machines A1 and B1, well, they can only guess that it's stalled, but they don't know when the coordinator is going to come back up. When the coordinator comes back up, it's going to try to tell A1 and B1 potentially to complete the transaction or not complete the transaction. They don't know. And this could leave us in a situation where, say, A1 decides, oh, let's abort that transaction, and B1, before it figures out that A1's doing that, decides, oh, the coordinator just came back up and told me to commit, let's do that. And we end up with that half-done scenario we were trying to avoid, you know, that our naive solutions did. So we can't do C unless we have some way of ensuring that, you know, when A1 and B1 are going to prevent the transaction from actually committing. And that's sort of, the coordinator is going to try its best when it comes back up, potentially to contradict that. We're not sure, which is why we can't just commit it, but it potentially could contradict that, and we need to make sure that never happens. Yes? Question for A, would it have to be true that one of those other machines would have to be functioning with a coordinator for it to work? So one of the machines involved in the transaction needs to be a coordinator. And presumably that is not the same coordinator that is down.
And I think I was a little bit thrown off in answer A because the answer B explicitly said it uses a different coordinator. So when answer A didn't explicitly say it uses another coordinator, I thought it was saying complete a transaction with another machine somehow without the coordinator.
Okay. Yeah, So you're saying you were confused that you thought there was something special that I should have used consistent phrasing in A and B, I agree, which I didn't. But the intention was that both of them presumably need to have different coordinators. Yes. So the question is, how do we know that a transaction that, you know, that we're worried about completing isn't one that shares a resource and therefore would have to wait until we know about this previous one? We don't. But the question is saying, can we complete transactions, not any transaction? Right? And there's certainly, if we think of all the operations we can do on items and orders, right, there's certainly tons of them that we should be able to complete. Right? It's only a small portion of them that we should have a problem with. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
On question one, I was a little confused about why it would be the server stub that sends the strings over in the return array over the network. Is it on the slides from 419, it says that the server stub does the conversion of bytes to arguments and return value of bytes, but then it shows the actual RPC library sending things over the network. So it didn't seem to me like the server stub would be the thing that actually sent the data over.
Oh, so your question is for B, shouldn't it be through the RPC library? I probably should have been more precise about that and say, like, we'll cause them to be sent. I'll need to think about whether I want to deal with that misunderstanding. But, like, yes, I was just being less direct, like, in the sense that I was thinking, like, oh, if you F write to a file, that's like, do you write things to disk? Well, yes, but not directly. You know, same idea. But yes, I agree that that phrasing could have been more precise. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Will question one be adjusted? Of course, A, we assume using the same coordinator that failed. If you're explicit about that, probably. If you aren't, probably not, because, like, if you're explicit about it, then what you say, I'm not sure what other machines meant, if it means with the coordinator, yes, otherwise, no. In that case, your comment tells us what you thought the answer would be under both interpretations, and we can give you credit. But if you just said, I don't know if the coordinator's involved, like, we can't really know if you understand what's going on or not. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so when we finished up, we were looking at sort of this state machine idea that we can have, should go to here. we can sort of say, oh, the coordinator, initially we're waiting for a transaction to come along. Then a transaction comes along, we go to this waiting state. To do that, we tell everyone about the transaction. And on a failure, we're going to say, oh, what state are we in? We're in the waiting state. So let's make sure we redo what we did to get in there, send the transaction to everyone. And in the waiting state, we are going to be collecting votes and asking for votes again if we don't get them. And eventually, we'll tally up the votes and either decide to commit or abort. And when we commit or abort, we tell everyone about that. And potentially, if needed, tell them again. On the worker side, we have sort of a similar picture that we're going to initially be waiting for a transaction, and then we get a prepare message from the coordinator and we decide, can I promise to accept this or not? And if I can promise to accept it, I remember that I agreed to commit, so I know I can resend that to the coordinator over and over again if it asks. And eventually the coordinator will either tell me to commit or abort. And when that happens, I remember that I got that in case the coordinator asks and actually perform the operation or discard it. Questions? Yes?
So the red arrows are in the event that a crash occurs and you have to redo the operation?
Question, the red arrows are in the event a crash occurs and we have to redo the operation? No. So the red arrows, so it depends on which red arrow. So we're saying that, let's say I told the coordinator I agreed to commit and then I get asked again, what is your vote? I'm going to say I agree to commit again. Or if I told the coordinator I agree to abort, I'm going to say I agree to abort again. And it could be because there was a crash that the coordinator is asking me twice, but it could also just be that the coordinator lost my original vote. But in either case, our action is the same. We're going to just tell them again and again, that's what I decided to do. Yes? Sorry? Question, after receive agree to commit, how can we? After we receive agree to commit? So this is the worker, so we're sending agree to commit. And I'm in these examples, I'm calling the message the coordinator tells us either commit or abort, because in the worker side, we're sort of making our votes about what we think should happen, but the coordinator's messages, they aren't votes, they aren't suggestions about what we'd like to happen, they are the decision. So if the coordinator tells us to abort, doesn't matter what we think, we're aborting. If the coordinator tells us to commit, doesn't matter what we think, except that the coordinator shouldn't have decided to do this if we didn't agree to do it, but we're committing. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. And like with the coordinator, a way we can think of recovering from failures with these workers is that, when we come back up after a failure, we look at how we got into his state. We say, oh, if we're in agreed to commit, I'm going to tell the coordinator again my vote. If we're committed, I'm just going to make sure the operation's actually done. If we're aborted, I can tell the coordinator we're aborting, in case it needs to know, even though it probably already does, and so. Some questions? So these diagrams are kind of informal, but sort of the advantage of having this sort of state machine view is that if I'm doing this more formally, I can list out for every state, every message, what do I do? So what do? If I receive an abort message and I'm in the aborted state, I can think about, I do nothing. What do I do if I receive the abort and I'm it? Oops, that's a case I forgot about, but I just go to abort it. But I never actually got asked to vote, but we're not doing it anyway, so it doesn't matter. And I can kind of enumerate all the possibilities in this way and make sure I don't miss a case, which is a common source of confusion when you're implementing protocol like this, so that you might not know what to do. Well, you can just say, here are the possible states, here are the possible messages, what happens for each of them, and make sure everything's handled. And also, potentially, we could write a program that makes sure that certain things are impossible to happen, like that we don't end up aborted unless the coordinator sends an aborted message to someone, for example. questions? Okay, so we have an assignment coming up for users to faith commit. So in this assignment, to keep things as simple as possible, we have a bunch of workers, which rather than like having like student records on one worker and course records on another or some scenario like that, they all store one value. And the idea is that the value changes in unison on all the workers. And we're gonna have a single coordinator. We're never gonna switch coordinators. We're just gonna use one all the time that sends messages to or from workers to change the values. And since the values are changing all of them at the same time, if I ask each worker for its value, all the workers are either gonna tell me the same thing, or they're gonna tell me that, you know, some of them are gonna tell me the value is not available because it's being changed right now. And we want this to happen even if there's failures. So that's the overall goal. And for this assignment, you're gonna have all the communication via RPC calls. So coordinators are gonna talk to workers by making RPC calls. So the workers are each gonna run an RPC server. We have sort of built supplied code which implements one of the naive algorithms we mentioned, that we mentioned doesn't work in failures and also gives us inconsistent values when things are changing. But we have a naive implementation that has everything working, but it uses a naive algorithm that's not two-phase commit, and therefore will become inconsistent, especially if there's failures. But in this design, the coordinator makes RPC calls to the workers. And for the assignment, the only way the workers can talk to the coordinators is by replying to an RPC. So the coordinator in this design is going to initiate contact with all the workers. This doesn't change what we do substantially, even though maybe it's not super realistic, but it certainly makes testing a lot easier, which is why I went with this design. And you have to do that. There's not going to be any way for your workers to contact the coordinator directly. So the coordinator needs to ask the workers something to get it. The RPC system is going to handle all the issues of if the network's down, if the worker's down, and so on, by throwing an exception. The assignment's in Python, so you'll get a Python exception. Please do not catch these exceptions. We'll talk about that later. And because the coordinator has to communicate directly with the workers, the coordinator needs to verify that when it tells all the workers to commit a report, that they actually got that message. Because if it doesn't do that, well, if they lose it, there's nothing that's going to trigger otherwise to make sure that we resend that. Because even though it's possible in a real system for the workers to like contact the coordinator and say, hey, I missed what happened to this transaction in this design, because the coordinator has to contact the workers, that's not possible. The coordinator is going to have to make sure the message gets there. Something which confuses people is that in the system, workers may never agree to abort. That's fine. Workers may always say, I'm committing. That's okay. In which case, maybe the only reason the coordinator would abort if there's a network failure or something, or possibly not even then, maybe we'll just redo the transaction. And that's okay. Because it's a simpler scenario, we don't have things like, oh, the course is full, or oh, I'm out of disk space, sort of as reasons to abort. Yes?
What do you mean by no conflicting operations?
What do I mean by no conflicting operations? The bottom. So remember when we said one reason we'd agree to abort in a real two-phase system is like you tried to add a course and I don't know if the course is full or not. We don't have that sort of scenario because the value is always being changed to something that it could change to. Unlike sort of our real systems where maybe you're trying to do a transaction that might not be legal, depending on current state. Okay, so in the assignment, in a real two-phase commit system, there's things like, oh, if it takes too long to get a response, we try again, and so on. To simplify the assignment, we're going to handle restarting things. So when there's a failure, what we want you to do is crash. Just crash, and we're going to restart things. And the idea is that when we restart things, you need to either recover from the failure, or maybe there's another failure and you'll crash again. In which case we'll restart you a second time. And this means that when your coordinator boots up, we're gonna reboot it on a failure. It should start by checking its log and seeing what do we do in response to that based on what's logged. and make and try to get the workers back up to speed, up to a consistent state. So questions about failure recovery? Yeah. Question, do I mean throwing an exception? That is probably the easiest way of returning an error. Yes. Yeah. Question, the coordinator, once it receives an acknowledgement from the worker, does it delete that message from the log? It can do so. But if it doesn't, well, what's going to happen is we reboot the coordinator, and the coordinator does the operation again on reboot. That's already the last operation. It's not a problem. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah. Question, does throwing an error automatically kill the coordinator? The way the RPC system works, no. It just makes that exception return an error. Our testing code will restart the coordinator, though. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So on the assignment, you can have a bunch of errors can happen. So you can send an RPC, and it could get lost. This is something our testing code will simulate. You can send an RPC, and it could actually get to the other side, but the reply or acknowledgement, the return value, could get lost. Both of these will look the same. And we have a third one. It gets sent, but it's delayed. And it's worth talking about what that looks like, and you know that you need to handle it. So, for example, let's say I have two different transactions, and I make my first transaction, and it doesn't work. I get it doesn't get to the second worker. Something was lost in the network, so I end up rebooting and trying that again. And now it gets sent to both workers, and then we finish things. And then we start a new transaction, and I just given IDs to these transactions so we can tell, oh, this is the prepare for the first transaction, this is the prepare for the second transaction. So we just resent it later. But what could have happened is maybe that transaction, that first prepare message wasn't lost, maybe it just got sent slowly, especially if we're like doing two transactions rapidly after another. In which case, maybe we'll actually get this old prepare message. And we need to make sure that we, when we see this new transaction here on worker two, that we realize, wait a moment, this is transaction ID zero. I've already handled that. Let's not try to handle it despite there being transaction ID one. The only reason I must be getting transaction ID zero is because something got lost on the network and then eventually got delivered. But I need to know to ignore that, and it's safe to ignore it because, well, the coordinator will have resent it anyways. So, questions about this reordering scenario? Yes?
Does this lead to like an ever-growing log that just gets bigger and bigger than one
year? So the question is, because we have, does this mean we have to remember all these prior transaction IDs? And that would be one solution. Something we can do, which maybe is more practical, is that if we have a timestamp in a real system or just sequential ID numbers, we can just say, oh, the coordinator already gave me transaction 15, so any transaction 14, 13, 12 must be things I've already done. And that's kind of a practical solution. And if we had multiple coordinators, we don't have any assignment, you could still implement the solution by just remembering, oh, for coordinator, you know, one, the last ID was 15, for coordinator two, the last ID was 20, and still use that same type of solution. Yes?
So the worker two can like, safely ignore the delayed request from the coordinator because you can assume that there's already like a resent prepare request.
The worker two can ignore this delayed request because it can assume it's already been resent. Yeah, and it knows the fact that it already got this prepare message. And it knows that, in fact, it got a commit message for it. So we can be sure that this prepare message must be something old. Does that answer your question? If we just got a duplicated prepare message, well, then that would just mean that our first prepare message response must have been lost. But in this case, we already got a commit message, so the coordinator already got a response. Or if it didn't get a response, it didn't care. Does that answer your question? Is it possible for the workers to do transactions out of order? So in a real system, we'd have multiple transactions that are independent of each other, in which case we could do them in different orders, and it wouldn't matter. In our system, we have one value being updated, so we can't really do two different updates at the same value at once. So we have to finish one transaction before we move on to the next. In this scheme, what's the protection against doing it out of order? So the simplest version of the scheme is that we only allow one transaction from a coordinator at a time, and we can just reject other transactions. If we wanted to allow multiple transactions at a time, we just remember, we've done all the transactions up to some ID number, and we have, these are the pending transactions, and I just for transaction 10, we're in the prepare state. For transaction 11, we're in the commit state. For transaction 12, we're in the prepare state, and so on, and just handle each of them sort of as separate instances of the protocol. Does that answer your question? If we're in the commit stage for 11 and 10 is not a transaction that's been finished, we could, in a system that handled multiple transactions at once, we could say, I'll commit 10. We might reply in that sort of way. In our system, it's not meaningful to have multiple transactions at a time because we only have one data being manipulated. So if we had two transactions at a time, they always conflict. There's no reason to allow that. And there's only one coordinator, so we don't have to worry about two different requests to do the same thing. The coordinator should be resolving that. Yes? So the question is, for the system, both the workers and coordinators need to know about this sort of these valid IDs? Yes. To answer your question?
Yeah.
So what infrastructure are you using to store all this? So question is, where are we storing all this? So you only have one piece of persistent storage on the workers and the coordinators, and that's the log. The way we give you a logging library in Python, which can just store a Python object. So you can make a Python dictionary, for example, and put whatever you want in it. Other questions? Okay, so in the assignment, we can have, so let's look at some of the failure cases just to sort of review what we talked about two-phase commit last time. So let's say we have the worker fails after preparing. So what could happen? The coordinator asks to prepare. It gets a result from one worker, but not the other. An assignment will crash your coordinator and reboot it. In that case, on reboot, it could ask for the worker's vote and agree to commit. So that's probably the most straightforward solution, is that we just redo what we were doing and finish it. And another option is that the coordinator could say, do something simpler. Remember, we said that if you don't have all the votes from the workers, an option you have is just not doing the transaction. You could just say, try again. So an option we could have is that, the coordinator doesn't get a response. We, in the assignment, we reboot the coordinator. The coordinator comes back up and says, I don't have all the responses. Let's just undo the transaction. And that's perfectly valid too, and possibly simpler. And you could say one of these might be a better, one of these might seem more efficient or easier, but they're both valid solutions. They both give us our guarantees that things are going to be consistent, and that things are going to work when there aren't failures. And this is a failure case, so it doesn't really matter if the transaction completes or not. Yes?
So what would you do if when the coordinator sends the signal to workers 1 and worker 2 for some reason, worker 2 becomes unresponsive to the network?
Question, what happens in this case if worker 2 doesn't respond to this? So in the assignment, because only the coordinator can contact the workers, we're going to get an acknowledgement back from each of these workers. And if you don't get that acknowledgement, you need to keep retrying, telling it to abort. Yes?
How do we know it is wrong in terms of the code? How will we know if the worker
question in terms of the code, how do we know if the worker's unresponsive? To contact the worker, you make an RPC. And in an RPC library, all RPCs have a return value. So if you don't get that return value, it's going to, the RPC library will throw an exception. Does that answer your question? So that means you should be trying to catch that exception? That shouldn't be necessary, because if you don't catch the exception, what's going to happen is your coordinator call is going to crash, and that's going to be trigger us to restart your coordinator. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
If there's a failure, like you said here, and you just basically, like, I guess on reboot, you just say, all right, like, I didn't get all the workers' calls back, like, to abort the transaction. Is it on the coordinator or on whoever was?
So the question is, who's deciding to abort? It's the coordinator.
Yeah.
Remember?
To retry that transaction, is it then on the coordinator to, like, restart it from the beginning?
The question is, who would restart the transaction? So in our system, someone would have to make another call to the coordinator to start a transaction. In a real system, like a database, like the database system would automatically, like, do that again. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so that's our that. And, right, and I mentioned that, okay. And so, other thing to mention is, let's say a worker fails during commit, so the coordinator needs to remember, I mentioned this earlier, to send the outcome again. So, we're in our assignment, we're going to have these sort of acknowledgments, because the coordinator has to, like, make sure the commit actually gets there. And if that doesn't happen, the coordinator needs to tell them commit again. Yes.
So once the coordinator gets assigned that both of them agree to commit, it then needs to tell the workers to actually commit. And if the workers don't say that they've committed, you haven't actually committed.
Question: once the coordinator finds out they both agree to commit, tells the workers to commit, yes. And if it doesn't appear that they committed, they haven't actually committed, so they may have actually committed the operation. Because we can't, so in this example, like, worker two didn't get the first commit message, but it could also have happened that it did, but the response didn't get back. But in either case, the coordinator can't tell, so it needs to send another, tell worker two to commit again, just in case. That answer your question? So the question is, let's say the coordinator keeps sending something to the worker two and it never replies. What happens? Well, the coordinator cannot make progress. Like, it can't finish this transaction. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's other things about the two-phase assignment. Before we talk about our next topic, which will be not distributed, yes.
About using the given test case, how do we manually test if something works or not?
Question, without using the given test case, how do we manually test if something works or not? So with the assignment, we have scripts to, like, run the coordinator and worker yourself. So it's hard to inject certain types of failures very much, which is why we have the test scripts. Like, it's hard to, like, make it so it receives something but doesn't reply. You could potentially do that by, like, putting, like, a sleep statement in your RPC and then control C-ing or something like that. You can certainly inject failures if you have, like, the worker running in one terminal and the coordinator in another. You can control C a worker, right? And that's the worker shutting down, essentially. And things should still work despite that and things like that. Does that answer your question? Yeah. If you pass no fail test and failure test, are you guaranteed 100? No, I think those tests cover all the interesting scenarios, but in the event that you're doing something like, oh, if the value is A, then the next value I return is B, or anything like that, there might be a problem, and I may write tests to detect those sorts of things. And as a concrete example, I have deliberately broken people's code who do things like say, oh, the values in the test go A, B, C, so I'm gonna check if the value is less than the previous one. You should expect that to break. Yeah.
So if we don't do that,
I would expect it to pass, but yeah, I might run different tests, but I think the supply tests cover all the interesting scenarios. Other questions, comments? Okay, so our next topic, we're gonna talk a little about security. And talk about actually protection and security. So protection, in terms of operating systems, is about mechanisms for controlling accesses to resources. And we've seen a bunch of things that kind of classify as protection. So page tables control access to physical memory. Preemptive scheduling controls access to the processor, to processor time. And there's other things we haven't talked about and probably won't, like encryption is a way of controlling access to data. And for the purposes of operating systems, we're going to talk about security, which is going to be using protection mechanisms to prevent misuse. And misuse is a very vague term. It can mean a lot of things. But there's going to be some sort of policy that we want to enforce about how resources can be used, and our protection mechanism is going to allow us to implement that policy. But that policy is going to be based on this definition of this term, which can mean a lot of things, of misuse, whatever that means. You know, don't expose my sensitive info to bad people. You know, that's my policy. And I'm going to implement it partly by, for example, page tables aren't going to let processes running on behalf of bad people access data that is sensitive. In this class, we're going to be talking mostly about mechanisms. But a good mechanism should give us the flexibility to encode interesting policies. Now, I mentioned that like page tables and preemptive scheduling, we can think of as a protection mechanism. They prevent, you know, they control access to resources. In the security point of view, there's something we're going to rely about these mechanisms that's different than in other scenarios, and that's that we're going to have adversaries. Sort of when we're thinking about processor scheduling, for example, or using a page table, we're usually thinking about what do programs typically do when they like mess up? Or, you know, how much computer time does a program typically get? We're thinking about sort of normal programs that aren't trying to do something bad. But in the world of security, we're worrying about adversaries, which are gonna choose the worst possible thing. They're gonna be able to do the research on how our page tables work, how our scheduling algorithm works, and figuring out the best thing to do for their goals, the most clever thing to do, you know, and not just typical things. So they're gonna try weird things that wouldn't make sense for any normal program to do, because they're gonna be designed to find the ways in which our mechanisms are incomplete. And that's gonna be a big difference when we're thinking about, you know, do our page tables provide security versus like, do they, you know, let us efficiently share memory? Do they prevent programs from breaking the system? You know, that's a different question. Okay, so one thing that comes up in a lot of policies we want to implement is that we want to have programs running on behalf of certain people or organizations be able to do things, and we want other programs not to. And to do this, we need to be able to identify who is who. So, and this is going to be called authentication. And based on that, we want to let certain people do certain things, and this is going to be called authorization. So once we've identified that, you know, I'm sitting in front of the machine, we want to allow programs I run to access certain things. So authentication seems like something that, well, we need to deal with in order to, you know, restrict access to resources to certain people, which is, again, a very common policy. And there's lots of ways you've probably done authentication. You can use a password. You might have some sort of physical hardware token that you might plug into a machine, for example. Things that are meant to identify a particular person, because only one person has the password, only one person has this physical token they plug into a machine, and so on. In this class, we're not going to deal much with how we do authentication, but we are going to deal with, if we've done authentication, we have to track, oh, this program is being run by this person and not some other person. We're going to deal with that part of things. And you might say, wait a moment, Don't we have to deal with authentication in order to have this information in the first place? Well, kind of. We're going to see the sort of Unix solution is that the sort of kernel part of the OS is mostly not going to actually deal with passwords or authentication tokens or anything like that, even though it's going to deal with the tracking part of it, of, you know, tracking who is who after we've done that authentication. So for now, we'll take it as a given that we figured out who's who and think about how do we control access to resources. Do you have a question over there? Nope, okay. So one way, sort of one brute force way we can represent who can do two is we can sort of assign our programs to what I'll call protection domains. And this is sort of just a generic term, and these could represent like a particular user or a particular group of users. So me personally on Portal, or all faculty running midterms on Portal could be a protection domain. So programs will belong to one or more of these domains, depending on who they're running on behalf of. And we'll say for each domain, for every single object in the system, objects being like files, processes, anything you can access, we'll define what operations you can do. And this sort of concept is known as an access control matrix. And this is sort of the brute force way of specifying what operations are possible for who. And sort of, and so the model is that we assign programs to one or more protection domains, and then we decide for each file, process, everything on the system, what can you do? And obviously, well, this matrix would be huge for a real system. We have potentially lots of users and tons of different objects. So we're not going to just store it as an actual big matrix, but we could store it as like only the entries that are filled in interesting ways. And there's other ways we're going to see to kind of summarize this information in a way which is more practical to store. But we're going to have something that represents this. We'll see sort of exact formats, and then we're going to enforce that. And how does the enforcement work? Well, we're going to check the protection domains, and when you try to say access a file, we're going to see, well, given your protection domains, can you read it? Can you write it? And so on. Yes? Question, how do we handle files that might be on one machine but aren't on another machine? So the question, how do I handle, so I think there's some confusion here. So this is on a single machine. Our protection domains are like different users or groups of users. They are things we're gonna assign processes to. But all the objects I'm listing are from a single machine. So I'm not talking about multi-machine access control. That's an interesting topic, but it's not what we're dealing with. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so first we'll talk about, we have these protection domains, what are they? And we're gonna talk about exactly how they work on both Unix systems and also commonly most other OSs. And the most common thing to do is have what are called user IDs. So there's gonna be some procedure that sets a user ID that represents a single user, usually thought of as a person, though it doesn't have to match that. It could have some other notion of what a user means. And every process has a user ID. And the user ID is going to be used to decide what operations the process can do. So in POSIX, POSIX has user IDs. There's a library called getEUID, which retrieves the current process's effective user ID. You might say, what other types of user IDs are there? We'll get to that later. But the effective one is the most important one. And the user IDs are just a number. So you might say, wait a moment, I don't type a number in when I log into Portal. I type in my computing ID. So there's some mapping from these numbers to names typically, but as far as the kernel's concerned, it's just a number. The kernel's not actually gonna deal with any of the names. And this effective ID is gonna be used every time you wanna check, can you do something? And as I said, there's going to be some standard mapping to names, but that's not going to be just library stuff. It's just going to be part of the standard library and standard programs. the actual kernel code, all it's going to see is this ID, which is just a number. So I mentioned we have these user IDs. I mentioned we also had these protection domains, which kind of represented groups of users. And POSIX also has group IDs. Sort of on portal, an example, there's a group for CS faculty. There's a group for students. And a process can be assigned at multiple group IDs. So there's an effective group ID. And then there's some extra group IDs. So processes can belong to multiple groups. And again, these groups are identified with numbers in the kernel, but the standard library might know of a way of mapping these numbers to names. But the kernel doesn't care about those names. It just uses numbers. So questions about IDs? Okay. So for example, on a department machine, if I run the program ID, incidentally, it lists all the current group and user IDs of my program. So it says, oh, my user ID on that department machine is 858182. My effective group ID is 21, which is CS faculty, and I'm also in the instructors and CS 4414 groups. Yes? Question, is the conversion of the name done in the kernel? No, this is all just part of a library. So the kernel has no knowledge of what the names are. The kernel just has these numbers. It has the user ID and all these group IDs. Does that answer your question?
So is the conversion done in user mode then?
The question is the conversion done in user mode? Yes. So there's some database that the names are looked up in. And the format that database takes varies. I'm not specific about it. Yes? Question, who sets up the database? The system administrator. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So here, my group kind of just is things implied by the user, right? User. My computing ID, well, that must be faculty instructors in 4414. Sometimes we can have groups that don't correspond to users. So for example, you might have a video group for access to the monitor. So processes in the video group are allowed to access the monitor. Processes that aren't in the video group aren't. And you might say if you log in to the system directly, you get into the video group, otherwise you don't. So if you SSH in, you're not in the video group, otherwise you won't. And this is kind of a way we can control access to specific resources. Now, this isn't actually as useful as it sounds. And the big reason why is that, let's say I log into the machine in person, and I leave a process running in the background, and I log out. That process that I leave running in the background, it's still in the video group, which maybe isn't the intention of this design. So maybe this isn't actually such a great way of controlling access. But that's sort of part of the theory behind having groups, is that the groups of processes and don't have to correspond to just the user. They can be sort of secondary factors. Okay, so let's talk about representing sort of these permissions, that for every object we want to say what things you can do with it. And there's sort of two main mechanisms that are used in practice to do this. So one idea is that with every file or process or whatever object you can access, we're going to have what we'll call an access control list. We'll have a list of who's allowed to do what with it, what protection domains, users, and groups can use it in what ways. Another option is that we can have some sort of separate database of like domain, object, and operation pairs that are stored on the side. And as an example, there's something called AppArmor that sometimes exists on Linux, which basically works in this way, where you have some global configuration file which gives these settings, and the system enforces those. We're going to talk primarily about access control lists because they're by far the most common type of mechanism. And POSIX specifies two types of access control lists, one of which is on every Unix-like, and one of which some people have decided to implement and some people haven't. We're going to start with these sort of basic POSIX file permissions. which are a very restricted access control list. So basic files and file permissions is that files are assigned a user ID, and for that user ID, you specify whether they can read, write, or execute the file. Also, that user ID is called the owner of the file and has the additional access of being able to change the permissions on the file. And that's just by virtue of being the listed user ID. There's also one group ID, and there's a read, write, or execute permission for that group. And then there's a default setting for everyone who's not, doesn't match the given user or group ID, whether they can read, write, or execute. And if you've used the chmod command, this is what the chmod command is manipulating. These read, write, execute bits for the user, a particular, the user ID specified with the file, the group ID specified with the file, and for everyone else. Yes?
Does the group of the file have to contain an order?
Question is, does the group of the file have to contain an order? Absolutely not. It can be any number. Now, you as an owner of a file can't set an arbitrary group number, but once that group number is set by someone who has permission to do so, it can, doesn't have to relate to the user. Does that answer your question? Yes? Question, how exactly are adversaries involved with this? So our hope is that if our policy is that only I and programs running on my behalf can access a file, that setting my user ID can read or write and execute the file and no one else can is going to prevent an adversary from actually accessing the file. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, the default setting means no one else can rewrite or execute. So depending on how, so we have a default we can set for if someone's not in the user and group, what they can do. And we can set that default to whatever we like. We can set it to neither read, write, nor execute. We can set it to read only, whatever, or some combination. Does that answer your question? Okay. So these are very restricted. So I showed you this access control matrix where we can like put anything anywhere. And here, what I'm saying, you can specify one user that can do things that are different than everyone else and one group, and that's it. That seems horribly inflexible. And so POSIX defined that, but not all Unixes actually adapted it. And also like Windows has, for example, more flexible access control lists. And in this sort of design, we just have a list of user, group ID, read, write, or execute with as many users and groups as we want, essentially. It's like, obviously, there's some limit because we're running out of disk space, but we have sort of standards for this. So for example, POSIX standardized version that I mentioned isn't supported everywhere, but where it is supported, this is the sort of syntax used to configure it. You say, oh, the students group can read or execute this thing. The faculty group can read, write, or execute. This user can read, write, or execute. This user can do nothing. And you can basically specify that read, write, or execute operation separately for every user and group as you want. So questions? Yes?
So are they setting these rules for each file?
Question, are they setting these rules for each file? So a system administrator or a user can set these rules separately for each file, each directory, as they choose. Yeah.
If the user doesn't have any permissions, how does he even know that the file exists?
Question, if the user doesn't have any permissions, how does he know the file exists? So the way permissions work on Unix, knowing whether a file's in a directory is about the permissions on the directory, not on the file. Does that answer your question?
So if the user doesn't have any permissions, they can see that there is a file, they just can't.
So question, if the user doesn't have any permissions, they can see that there is a file? So if I don't have any permissions to a file, but have permissions to the directory it's in, I can still list that directory to see the file. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah?
The access control, so because we're using access control lists in order to represent the access control matrix, then do we need to have a list of lists or a dictionary list?
Question, because this is supposed to represent a sort of access control matrix, don't we need a list of lists? So this is an access control list. This would apply to the list stored with one file or directory. So we could have a separate list for every single file if we wanted. Does that answer your question?
So in reality, we represent the matrix, we
Question, in reality, the matrix sort of represented a multiple list? Yeah, so we'll have one of these lists for every file, potentially. Other questions? Yeah?
So when you ls-a, you get this user, a owner group, and everyone, right? How can you have two groups?
Question, when I ls-l, I get just user, owner, group. So the what that ls-l is saying is the simple restricted access control lists. So some systems, in addition, support these fancier access control lists. LS-L generally won't show you those. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So since all of this stuff came on the same machine, does that mean that like any user who logs into the machine for the first time can see all of the files? They just can't necessarily read.
The question is, since all of this is on a machine, does that mean any user can see all the files? So they can see the files if they have permissions on the directories the files are in. So if we set this access control list on a directory, then user TJ1A wouldn't be able to know what's in that directory. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we talked about representing user IDs and group IDs, so what sort of a program's running on behalf of, and deciding for those IDs what operations they can do. So how do we actually check those operations? And this is done on system call entry. So it has to be done in the system call, because you can write your own like system call wrapper, right? So we can't like do it in the system call wrapper. We have to do it in the system call in the kernel. And on Unix, like for example, when you open a file, that's going to check these permissions. When you rename a file, that's going to check the permissions on the directory to make sure you can modify that directory. When you kill a process, that's going to check to make sure you're allowed to kill that process, and so on. So questions? Checking. Yeah.
So you're saying there's no direct system wrapper function like open or rename we can call to directly check
question, if I wanted to check the authorization directly without calling open, there's no way to do that. Yes, so sort of as POSIX defines things, the way you find out if you're allowed to open a file is by opening it. It does turn out that POSIX defines a system called access, or a library called access, which checks those permissions separately, but it is very hard to use in a way that makes sense. Well, we might talk about why later. Okay, so we talked about checking permissions. So let's have some shortcuts here, questions here. So which of these things would be secure to do? So one question here is making a read-only page table entry to allow a process to access its current user ID without a system call. So typically get UID, get your current UID, that's a system call. Kind of like get PID is usually a system call, right? But maybe we could shortcut that by just allowing you to directly access the memory that contains that user ID or process ID. Would that be secure? B here. Let's say I mentioned that we have to perform the authorization checks in the system call handlers. Could we also perform them in the library wrapper, the open function you call before it makes a system call? Could it also be checked? Would that still be secure? Doing it instead? And what if we just make the user ID an argument of the system call instead? Yes?
Can you explain why A even makes sense?
Question, why would A make sense to do? So reading from the page table entry, reading from the page is going to be faster than making a system call. If I can just read from my process control block directly, rather than making a system call, having the kernel do that, copy it back to my EAX register for me, that's going to be a lot faster. Question, doesn't that mean any user can read from it? It depends where our read-only page table entry is. Depends what process it's mapped to. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so let's start with A. Who thinks A would still be secure? bunch of people who thinks A would not still be secure. Okay, so someone want to tell me why they think A would not still be secure? Yeah. Okay, so your concern is, what if there's other data in there? So that is probably a concern. And I would say that, so this would be yes if no sensitive data elsewhere in the page. You have to make sure there's no sensitive data elsewhere in the page. If you're concerned about that, something you might do is you might put this data in a separate page so you can just make that page shared. And this strategy actually is really used for sharing certain data between user programs and the kernel on many systems. So Linux, for example, implements some system calls by actually just having the kernel share a page of read-only data that the process can retrieve. Yes?
So if we're given a similar question on a quiz and asked us whether or not it's secure, should we always say no because we should always be considering whether it's
going to be? We would need to be more specific on a quiz. Specify what else is in the page, or make it clear that other things could be in the page. But, so the question, in this case, like, the rest of the process control block, it's not clear whether that's sensitive or not, like, even if it's in the page. Okay, how about B? Who thinks B would be secure? Okay, who thinks B would not be secure? Okay, so I think B is, yes, it's secure. Yes, because of the in addition to. That it doesn't allow the program to do anything it couldn't already do. Now, is it a good idea? No. Why isn't it a good idea? Well, because we're doing something twice, we don't really need to. You might say, well, find out we're not authorized faster. Maybe. The other thing is that whether we're authorized could change between the two checks. Right, we could determine we're authorized, make the system call, and then like the file permissions change and we're not authorized. So it's not really useful to check twice. Yes, but not useful. So probably, like, and also probably you don't fail the checks very often, so it's not really worth optimizing that. Okay, how about C? Who thinks C would be secure? Would not be secure? Okay, so would not be secure? No, because I can write my own standard library. My own library. So my program can supply its own library that conveniently omits those checks and get around this problem. How about D? Who thinks D would be secure? Would not be secure? Okay, so the problem with D is that either we're ignoring that argument, or if we're not ignoring that argument, the user program can check it. You might say, but the library setting it, well, they can use their own library. They can write their own standard library and use that instead of calling the normal system call wrapper. No program can set its own, set any user ID, you know, by writing its own system call, calling function. Some questions? Yeah.
For option A, if you're only accessing an only single entry, then why does it matter for different?
Question for option A, if I'm only accessing a single entry, what does it matter? So the problem, the concern people had is that if I'm making the page containing the user ID writable, everything else on that page, I'm making everything else on that page readable, that's the rest of the process control block. And I have to be sure that there's nothing in the rest of that process control block that you're not allowed to see. And it's not only the rest of the process control block, like we think of XV6, it's also like, it's the whole page, so it could be like that process control block and the next one in the array of process control blocks, for example. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Can I explain the difference between authorization checks and system call versus library?
Yeah.
So the authorization check is, can this user ID access this file or whatever based on the access control list or however we're storing who can do what? So those checks, typically would be done in our system call implementation. So like when we open, part of the open operation is before I return a file descriptor for you, I'm going to say, can you actually access this file? And if the answer is no, I'm going to not return a file descriptor to you. I'm not going to allocate one. Does that answer your question? Okay, so we've talked about user IDs and sort of normal permission checking. There's one special user ID, which is going to be user ID 0. So on Unix, user ID 0 is sometimes called super user or root. And user ID 0 is just special cased on system calls. So some system calls are only going to work for user ID 0. So for example, typically the shutdown system call only works for user ID 0. Normal user is not allowed to do that. Also, most permission checks, if your user ID is 0, are just going to ignore the access control list and say, yep, you pass. So the name super user comes from, well, they can do anything that any user can do, because they basically just are a special case in all the permission checks that says, yes, you're allowed. No matter, you're not going to be restricted by the access control list and so on. Okay, so we know about the special user 0. So let's talk about logging in. So I go up to a machine, type in a username and password, and there's some program I'm typing my username and password into here, which can check if the password is correct and change user IDs. Let's talk about how that works. So first of all, it has to check if the password is correct. So how does it do that? It has to have some way of knowing where the correct passwords are. And the typical, single Unix machine solution is that we have a file, most common name is etcshadow, which is only readable by root or super users. It just has access control list, which says only user ID 0 can access this file, and it has the password information in there, and I can check from there. On a network machine, like the department machines, there's a network service that the program can send an encrypted password to in some way, and it says back, yes, that's really this user, the right user. And it just checks with that network service to see if you're actually have the right password or not. And use some cryptography to verify it really comes from the server and not from someone who plugged an Ethernet plug into somewhere and tried to send yes, it's the right user messages. So this is something that's just being done by a program. So this is not something that's being done in the kernel. This is just a program that's doing this. So this login program, the only thing special is that it's run early, but it could just use any criteria at once to decide how to let you log in. So it doesn't need to use passwords. It could use, a physical token, biometrics, whatever. That's just changing the program that runs in user space, changing this code that's checking the password. Okay, so we have this program running that we enter our password into. It also needs to change user IDs. How does it do that? Well, on POSIX, there's a call for that. There's a call called setUID, which changes your user ID to a particular value. Obviously, we can't let everyone do this, or else preventing you from doing things if you have a certain user ID would be pretty meaningless. But if you're a super user, if your user ID is 0, you're allowed to change the user ID to anything. So the login program, the program that runs a boot, runs as this super user, and therefore it can call setUID to switch to user Joe. So the system starts and runs that login program as super user, and it calls this setUID to restrict its access back to some particular user rather than being this super user which can do anything. So questions about login process? Yes?
So like when switching from like non-super user 1 to like non-super user 2, do we have to log in as a super user?
So the question is, if we want to switch from, so I'm switching from super user to a non-super user. If I wanted to switch from non-super user to a different non-super user, how would that work? And there's multiple ways that can work, but the most common way is you'll have a program that runs in between that runs a super user. We'll talk about that scenario actually next. But other questions before I move on to that? Yeah. Question, only the super user can set the UID. So I deliberately didn't specify how this call works if you're not super user, but it works in a much more limited set of circumstances. And we'll get to those probably next time, maybe a little today. But if you're super user, you can use this unrestricted. If you're not super user, it's very limited. Yes? Sorry, what's the voluntary restriction? So the login program, initially it runs as super user. It can modify anything. And before it starts the shell, it's going to use this call to make sure it can't do anything anymore, right? It's giving up access by setting its user ID to something that isn't zero. Does that answer your question? Question, so the super user program sets its user ID to something else, yes. And then after it does that, it's no longer running as super user, no longer has that special case in all the access control checks. Does that answer your question? Okay, so this is about logging in. So one case that you may have experienced is that, you know, sometimes you can run a command to run something with extra permissions, and many of you have seen this sudo program, where you type some command after sudo, and it runs that command usually as super user, with those extra permissions where there's no permission checks anymore. And it asks for a password. And a question might be, how does this program work? How does this sudo program do this? So we're starting it from our shell, which doesn't run as super user. So we can't just call set UID to zero, because normal programs aren't supposed to be able to do that, right? You can go from super user to some other user, but we shouldn't be able to just have any user switch to super user. And indeed, this sudo program is asking for a password to make sure that you can't just, not just anyone could do that at any time. So how does it work? And the sudo program, well, it's an executable with an extra bit set in its metadata, typically its inode, typically next to the file permissions, called the set user ID bit. And there's a special case in exec where when we exec a program with the set user ID bit set, exec changes the user ID that we're running with to the owner of that executable. So the sudo program is owned by root, user ID 0. It's marked as set user ID, meaning that when we exec sudo, it runs with user ID 0 instead of the normal user ID that all our programs run with. Because it runs with user ID 0, it can run things as user ID 0, and it can also access like the password database and so on. So questions about this set user ID idea? Yeah.
So if I were to start a program, a program inode, and somebody else were to run that program, it would run it as if I were running it?
Question, if you were to set this flag, set your user flag in a program you own, and someone else ran it, we run as you were running it, yes. So this sort of idea of marking programs that says user ID is kind of a way of providing these controlled access to higher privileges. So we can have some functionality that only certain users, often root, but maybe other users, can access. And this program can let you do those things because whoever that user is, often the system administrator is that user, set up the program so you can run it and the program does things that you aren't allowed to do yourself. And sudo is a classic example of that. And this allows us to sort of add, you know, permissions for you to do things without modifying the kernel. So I can make a program that restarts the system. And I can mark it as set user ID so you can run it even though you can't normally restart the system. And by doing this, I'm letting you restart the system without modifying the kernel to tell it that let any user restart the system. I'm just writing a program that you can run that runs as a user who can restart the system and letting you do that. And I can use this to give you access to all sorts of functionality without actually changing how the kernel deals with permissions. All the kernel knows is, oh, there's a program that you're allowed to run that should run with this extra permission. Yes?
So basically there's something that if I'm the super user, then I don't need to go to kernel mode. I can use user mode to do something
like more than the diagram. Question is how this interacts with kernel mode. So the programs we're running with user ID 0 still run in user mode. The difference is that when a program with user ID 0 makes a, say, an open system call, open says, oh, your user ID 0, let's ignore the permission checks. But the program still ends up running in user mode. It's just that the kernel knows that programs with particular user IDs have their permission checks work differently. Does that answer your question?
So it doesn't actually need to access the access control
information. Question, so it doesn't actually need to access sort of access control information directly? No. Other questions? Okay, so we'll talk a little more about set user ID programs tomorrow, including why you should never write one. Or Thursday, rather. And maybe a little bit about VMs.